Welcome to Inflection Point, interviews with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. What's creative placemaking?
How can we make better use of existing space? How can we take what we have and give it back to people and give it back to neighborhoods and give it back to communities?
We talk with Alana Lipset about how unused real estate can bring communities together. Plus, what it takes to become a judge and what it takes to keep order in the court.
That is one place where having a robe on and a well-placed raised eyebrow can be helpful.
Women changing the status quo. That's our inflection point. Tech workers and homeless people, physical space and mindfulness. What does it take to bring all of this together? Our guest, Alana Lipset, is the founder of Free Space, a community, cultural, and arts center that started in an abandoned warehouse in San Francisco. She calls herself a creative placemaker. Alana Lipset, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us, what is creative placemaking?
Creative placemaking is a new way of describing creative urban development, a way of doing temporary actions, temporary activations, and really demonstrating what's possible in cities and urban life in the way that people engage with each other and their cities through temporary actions, whether it's an activation of a public space, of a park, of a building, or a pop-up, some way of engaging the community, of getting community input and participation in a way that will inform future development, ideally inform future development of a city or a neighborhood or municipal regulations or code or something along those lines.
Things that are more permanent, ultimately.
Things that are more permanent, exactly. It's a way of kind of testing out what works, what resonates with people, and how can we continue to engage people as we grow our cities, as things change, as we have different ideas for ways that we want people to be engaged.
And that could be across any aspect of a community, the arts, eating, what other kinds of things could it cover?
Exactly. Especially arts. I think that creative placemaking takes arts and takes creativity, as is indicated by the name, into the public realm and uses the arts as a community engagement tool. And whether that is for transportation management, whether that's for development of a building, whether that's for gathering input for what people would like to see in their community. It's something that people resonate with. It's kind of has universal appeal and interest and piques people's interest and curiosity and gets them engaged in a way that they weren't before. And so you see it all across the spectrum from participatory art to pop-ups to parklets, which were kind of the original creative placemaking prototyping model that started here in San Francisco, to in-room uses of vacant spaces and everything in between.
So when you say activating a space, what does that mean?
So despite the incredible development boom that we are seeing in San Francisco right now, there still is a lot of empty space and a lot of vacant space for a variety of different reasons. And what creative placemaking does, and a lot of the work that I've been doing does, is look for ways to bring energy, bring people to those spaces, even if it's only on a temporary basis. So if it's a food pop-up, or if it's like Free Space, a pop-up community center, or if it's a short-term festival, or even a morning festival, or something like Sunday Streets, a way of bringing people, bringing energy to a place that didn't have it before. A, is a way of showing what's possible in the existing infrastructure that we have, and B, is a way of connecting people to each other.
Well, you mentioned SF Space. Tell us what that was about.
Yes. So Free Space started in 2013 as an experiment, actually, as part of the National Day of Civic Hacking, which was a nationally sponsored hackathon for civic engagement, where the federal government, all these federal agencies, released data and released problem sets and encouraged civic hackers, people who wanted to be engaged in their community, all across the country to come up with solutions to a lot of the challenges that these federal agencies were facing. And what we decided to do in San Francisco was say, instead of taking a specific problem set, what happens if you give people space and then give them permission to be creative and to come up with their own problems and come up with their own solutions? And so what we did was get a 14,000 square foot warehouse in SoMa that had been vacant and got the landlord to agree to rent it to us for $1 for the month of June in 2013. And as soon as we got it, we turned it over to the community and invited people to come and create whatever they wanted and to use it as kind of a literal and physical blank canvas for creation. So we had artists paint the walls on the inside and the out. We had people come lead workshops. We had dance parties. We had cooking classes. We had book clubs. We had yoga. We had meditation. We had 120 free events in that first month alone. And our only rule was that it had to be free and open to the public. So we really encouraged participation. And I would say 99% of those 120 activities were participant driven. So people who came through Free Space and said, can I do this? Can I lead this class? Can I teach this workshop? And we said yes. And so they were able to have a place where they could manifest something that they had been dreaming about for a while.
And because it started with this National Day of Civic Hacking, were any of the solutions that come up with, were those then publicized or fed back into any kind of greater knowledge base in terms of what you learned?
There are a couple answers to that. The first is that in addition to the space having a ripple effect and people all over the world actually reaching out to us and saying, we want to do this in our city, how do we do it? And so we put together a toolkit for people who were interested in activating a vacant space, creating a community hub, which we were able to share. And various free space communities were activated in 12 countries all over the world. Another thing that we did was actually host hackathons. And so we had a number of different groups over the course of the time that we were there host a hackathon in the space, have it anywhere from 1 to 3 days, bringing in a group of people to work on a specific issue, and came up with solutions for a number of different challenges, including a maker skills training program for homeless people, a way of connecting female veterans to employment and education opportunities, and a number of different projects, which we then publicized and helped grow, and some of which we submitted back to the National Day of Civic Hacking to be included in their database.
And what's the, how do you define hacking? Isn't, you know, there are so many, it feels like it's become such a common term, but it has so many different meanings. Could you just explain how you would define that?
So even though I think hacking still has some negative connotations, the way that I like to think about it is taking something apart and putting it back together better. And so when you talk about a hackathon, specifically for a social impact cause, we're talking about, for example, homelessness, like I mentioned, or female veterans issues, presenting the challenges that those groups of people are facing, or a particular nonprofit is facing, or a particular cause is facing, and really taking apart all the different pieces of it and getting input from a variety of different people, from developers, from social workers, from creatives, from artists, from a whole host of people, and collaboratively putting these solutions together to address the initial challenge.
Who establishes the challenges?
Whoever decides to organize the hackathon.
Okay.
So I can give you an example. We put together a hacktivation, essentially a hackathon, for the homeless last year. And this was kind of in the height of the debate between the nonprofit community and the tech community, as more and more tech companies were moving into San Francisco, and there was a lot of anxiety and anger and really high emotions around how people were interacting with each other. And a couple of us were looking at this issue and saying, hey, tech isn't all bad. Tech is not going to solve homelessness, but it's not all bad. Let's see if we can bring together people from the nonprofit community who serve the homeless and people from the tech community who want to do something good with their skills and bring them together to collaboratively create solutions. And so we ended up working with 12 different homeless nonprofits over the course of about 3 months to find out from them which were their what were their biggest challenges and where could they use assistance. And they then pitched those challenges to a group of about 250 tech volunteers who then formed teams around them for the course of a weekend and came up with solutions to help manage their volunteer system better, or be able to better communicate with their clients, or figure out ways for their clients to text in case of an emergency. And it was a really amazing example of these two different communities that had really been at odds with each other coming together and working together, sitting at the same side of the table and building upon each other's skills and building relationships in the process.
And did that take place inside one of these vacant buildings that you have taken over?
That's a great question. We had some of the initial planning meetings in free space number 2, but the building itself was actually too small for the group. And so we had some borrowed space from one of the tech companies. And we also did it in Glide Memorial Church, which is a really great example of one of these spaces where really beautiful mixing of people happens and has been happening for years and years.
Do you see your job as bringing people together from coming from different perspectives on an issue?
Absolutely. That's one of the most important pieces of what I'm doing. I think it's really important to create spaces and create experiences where people can interact with each other at a very basic human level. And once they start to do that, they can begin to kind of drop the labels that they carry for themselves and for other people and realize that we all share this crazy human experience together. And while our lives might be really, really different, we have a lot more similarities than we recognize. And especially when we are talking about really difficult issues like homelessness or development or displacement, that coming from a basis of understanding and human connection makes those conversations happen in a more humane way.
I read about one of the participants in your community space that started his own business. Could you tell the story of him?
Yeah. So you're referring to Mark Roth, I believe.
Yes.
Who is formerly homeless. Shortly before the first free space opened, we read an article about him called Homeless to Hacker. And it was about how he had brought himself up out of homelessness after he enrolled in tech shop and taught himself all these maker skills and opened up his own laser cutting business and then wanted to do more and wanted to give back to the homeless community and wanted to show people that if they had exposure to various opportunities, that could have a huge impact on their lives. And so he wanted to create what's called the Learning Shelter, which is essentially a maker skills training program for homeless individuals. And he came to us at Free Space and he pitched his idea on our opening day. And everybody was so inspired by his story and really wanted to support him and help. And so we ended up hosting a hackathon for the Learning Shelter, bringing together about 60 people to come up with ideas for where it could be and partners and curriculum and a whole host of other elements that would make his program a success. And it is almost 2 years later, and the Learning Shelter is up and running and has graduated its first class of 5 participants, most of whom have full-time jobs now working in the maker space, whether it's woodworking or laser cutting or other types of creative maker jobs. And so that's been a really amazing success story to come out of Free Space and to really exemplify what happens when you take an idea and you give it to a diverse group of people and say, here's a problem, let's come up with a solution together. And so we had input from all these different people in Free Space who wouldn't necessarily have known about Mark Roth or his story or his program, and who came from all different backgrounds and could offer educational support, could offer social work support, could offer outreach support, could offer technical support, and really helped this program blossom.
Thinking about the name Free Space, the space was free to anyone who participated. Did anyone who was involved in this project get paid, or were they also doing it for free out of the goodness of their hearts?
Well, when we initially started, we thought it was just going to be a one-month experiment. And so we didn't really think about that, the participants or the organizers getting paid. And as it grew and as it became kind of an international phenomenon, we started looking at ways to make it more sustainable, because even though we were able to get a building that first month for a dollar, there are other costs associated with running a building. So we did need to do some fundraising, and we were able to run a successful Indiegogo campaign to help pay for some of those expenses. We won a grant from the city of San Francisco so that we could ultimately start paying some of the people who were helping to organize and run the space. But what was really amazing about it was how many volunteers it attracted and how many people wanted to get involved, not because they were getting paid, but because it was something that was really exciting and really fun.
And probably some good networking came out of it.
There were a lot of people who, through the experience, either met a future business partner or were able to pilot training programs that they're running now, or had a complete change of their life course because of the experience that they had in Free Space. And they were able to kind of refocus their priorities and follow some dreams that were really big for them.
So what's the creative space you're working on now?
So one of the spaces that I'm working on now is called The Hall, and it's actually right across the street from our second San Francisco free space. And it is a temporary project for a building that had been sitting vacant for about 7 years and is in pre-development. The developers who bought it are going to be building residential units. And they looked at the building and decided, we don't want to sit on this vacant building for the 2 to 3 years that it's going to take for permits and other planning processes to go through. And so they opened it up as a food and beverage hall and also a community space. And so I work as the community manager there and organize events that are open to the public, to the entire neighborhood. The hall itself sits kind of right on the border between the Tenderloin and where all these new tech companies have come in. And so it's a really interesting place. There's a lot of change happening. There have been a lot of emotional discussions about the change that's happening. And so what we are trying to do is really situate ourselves as a community resource and as an asset to the community, as a space where people can come and enjoy and also meet each other and also meet people who are on that other side of the spectrum and start to build these relationships that are so important for resilient communities.
And what is some of that discussion, and who are these different players that are getting pushed against? Is it the tech community and all of the conversation about the increase in rents and things like that, or what's the heart of it?
Definitely a lot of conversation about increase in rents and displacement and major changes happening. We're right across the street from Spotify, from Zendesk, a couple blocks down from Twitter. And so we feel very lucky to be in the position where we're in, because we can invite in people from those companies and people from those communities, and also people from residents from the neighborhood and nonprofits from the neighborhood, and invite them in to share a drink or watch music or do something that has universal appeal, and then also introduce them to a lot of the ideas that we are talking about, like having facilitated conversations about development and what that means in the neighborhood and how that feels. And having direct Q&As with the developers so people can get a chance to meet them and hear what their ideas are going to be and what the space is going to be. And we've also been able to have field trips with kids from the local schools and local after-school programs where they can come in and talk to the local vendors about entrepreneurship and what it means to be a small business owner, and also get a chance just to enjoy and have play games and have dinner and do it with volunteers from the tech companies who come over to hang out with them. And so it's a really great place for that type of mixing to happen and for people to be able to meet each other in a kind of neutral space and just enjoy each other's company and enjoy the exchange, and then also start to get into some of the more challenging conversations.
Are you also working with the city of San Francisco in a different capacity?
Yes. So I've been working with the Office of Economic and Workforce Development as a contractor on and off for the past 4 years. And a lot of the work that I've been doing has focused around this geographic area, the Central Market and Tenderloin area, and a lot of the changes that are happening there, and getting a picture of who is doing what in the neighborhood, where are there places that we can build stronger relationships, where there are places that we can build partnerships to address a lot of the challenges together and really make it a place that is welcoming and inviting for everybody, for people who've lived there for decades and for the people who are just coming in.
Why is the city of San Francisco interested in letting you fill these vacant spaces?
Well, I think, so first to clarify, the city is not giving me explicit permission to fill these spaces. That being said, I think that they and a lot of people in the area are very excited when these spaces do get filled, because there's so many things associated with vacant spaces that are a deterrent to growth or that are a deterrent to safety. And so having more activity in an area generally benefits everybody, and it brings a certain vibrancy to a neighborhood. And I think in a lot of these spaces, one thing that is really important is bringing the arts in and using the arts again as a community engagement tool and bringing people together around something with universal appeal, whether it's public performance or music or art, because I think that what that does is create strong ties in the neighborhood. And that is important for so many reasons that have to do with safety, that have to do with neighborhood resiliency, that have to do with building strong relationships among neighbors. And So to the extent that these vacant spaces can be filled, it brings energy, it brings vibrancy to the street, and it also sends a message that it's better to have activity. It's better to have people coming out. It's better to have places where people can gather, because again, in a lot of urban settings, we don't necessarily have those gathering spaces. And as I mentioned at the beginning, we have a ton of infrastructure and we have a ton of existing spaces that just aren't necessarily being used. And so how can we make better use of existing space? How can we take what we have and give it back to people and give it back to neighborhoods and give it back to communities where they can come together and enjoy and build stronger relationships and build stronger communities?
How did you get into this career?
A lot of trial and error and a lot of following my passion and my heart. And my background is actually in politics and in community organizing. I spent 5 years in Washington, D.C. doing labor organizing. And I came back to the Bay Area where I grew up to go to grad school to get an MBA in sustainable management. And while I was in school, I got an internship with the city, with the Mayor's Office of Economic and Workforce Development, and happened to be put on this amazing team of people working on the Central Market economic strategy, and got really involved in building relationships in that neighborhood and in getting to understand the community, and also looking at vacant spaces and understanding how we could make better use of these existing spaces. And I did food pop-ups for about a year, and I did a pilot project to bring more arts and cooking and dance to underutilized community spaces in the Tenderloin, and then got involved with Free Space, and everything just kind of kept opening up a door to something else. And it's been a really exciting evolution. Sometimes it's been scary, but it's been a really exciting evolution of seeing what happens when you open yourself up to possibility and are not afraid to be creative and to be experimental and to try new things.
What advice would you give to women who want to bring their own ideas into being?
Don't let yourself get in your own way. And don't be afraid to say out loud what you want to do and to go for it. And also, build a team and surround yourself with people who inspire you and who you inspire and who can help you get to where you're going.
And what's the best advice about leadership you've ever gotten?
The best advice I've gotten about leadership is to listen to other people, because a lot of times the best ideas come from other people, and people simply need an invitation to participate, to be creative, to put their own ideas forth. And when you listen to other people, they listen to you. And a lot of times I think leadership is not about you and it's not about what you want. It's about building a team, building a community, building something strong together. And that happens when you listen to other people.
Ilana Lipset, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Ilana Lipset, a creative placemaker in San Francisco. You're listening to Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. Coming up in the second half of the show, Noelle Wise, who is a judge for the Superior Court of Alameda County. Stay tuned. Hi, I'm Lauren Schiller. If you're enjoying Inflection Point, help us make more episodes. You can donate to the show on inflectionpointradio.org. Just go to the website and look for the donate button. It's super simple, and we will really appreciate it. You can show us how much you like us by going to our Facebook page at facebook.com/inflectionpointradio or follow me on Twitter at LA Schiller. Plus, sign up for weekly email updates at inflectionpointradio.org. This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. In its entire existence, only 4 women have been appointed to the Supreme Court, and in the federal system, only 24% of judges are women. Locally, though, last November, Noelle Wise was appointed to the Alameda County Superior Court, one of 24 women out of 75 total judges. Noelle Wise, welcome to Inflection Point.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
So what exactly is the Superior Court?
So the Superior Court is the trial level court in the state. And every state has a trial level, it has an appellate level, and then it has a Supreme Court level. And then we have a parallel federal system. And so in the state of California, at the Superior Court level is where you would hear things like regular criminal cases. You would hear robberies and rapes, and you would hear the domestic cases, and you also have civil cases that are heard there. And then we have appellate courts, and then we have the California Supreme Court that oversees the whole judiciary for the state. And it's the court of last resort, as they say, for the state. The federal side has something similar. So there are federal district courts. They are the trial courts. And then we have circuit courts of appeal. And then we have the United States Supreme Court.
And the circuit courts of appeal are somewhere between federal and the United States Supreme Court? Or so where do they fall?
The circuit courts are the first level of appeal after a district court. So the only difference between a federal district court and a state court at the trial level are the kinds of cases that they hear. Is it a federal case, a case involving the United States Constitution, for example, or something between an issue between two states that needs to be heard there? And if it's something that's specifically related to what's happening in the state, it would happen in a superior court to begin with.
Okay. And that's where you are, is a superior court.
Correct.
Why did you decide to apply?
I had been a lawyer at that point for about 21 or 22 years. I feel like it had been a really good career for me, that there were a lot of things I had done along the way that I enjoyed and I felt of use. But I also realized that I had less than half of my career ahead of me, and that I really thought about how I wanted to utilize that time. And the time at the beginning of my career at the Justice Department, where I was doing public service, was incredibly meaningful. And
you were there under Janet Reno.
I was. I very much enjoyed that. It was a great place to work and a great place to learn how to be a lawyer and to work on cases that felt quite meaningful. And I think when I applied, I really was at that point in my career where I had constantly been doing the next thing I thought I should be reaching for, the next thing that seemed logical to aspire to. And I hadn't often thought about whether I was on the best path. I hadn't really given myself the latitude to think about that. And I did before I applied. I really thought about my skill set, and I thought about what are the things that I'm good at and what are the things that I'm not as good at and what's the best use of that skill set. And I really thought that this would be potentially a good fit for me.
And can anyone apply for a judgeship?
Do you want to apply?
I'm guessing I don't have the qualifications from a legal standpoint.
So in the state, because the process is different on the state and the federal side of how it works, but in the state, you have to have been a lawyer for at least 10 years, and you have to not have a history of having issues in terms of your legal career and in ethics or other things that might have led to issues with the California bar, for example. And so if you're in good standing with the bar and you've been practicing for that long, you can apply.
And what was the application process like?
Long. The application itself took me about 4 months to prepare, to gather all the information that I needed for it, because it asks about all of the places that you've worked and all of the significant cases that you've worked on. And it wants to know the names of all of your opposing counsel in those cases and the judges who heard those cases and places that you've taught and nonprofits that you've worked with and many other things that I now can't remember.
Reconstructing your entire career history.
Essentially, it was. And then after you submit your application, then it's vetted through the governor's office. And at some point, you get to an entity called the Judicial Nominations Evaluation Commission. And if you make it to that spot, then they ask you for an additional 75 names beyond those that are in your application as references that they reach out to.
That's all, just 75.
I think they want to be reasonable.
Did you have to reach back to kindergarten?
They want people primarily who are connected to you in your professional life. They also reach out randomly in the legal community for people that you may not have listed. And then after you get through that process, if you make it through that, then eventually you're interviewed through the governor's office and then potentially appointed.
And how long did the whole process take for you? You said it took 4 months to fill out the application. And
so after I applied, it took about 13 months from the application until I was appointed, perhaps 14, pretty close to that.
And what's the difference between being appointed and being elected?
So whether you're appointed or elected, your name will come up eventually in the election cycle for the slot that you're in. And most judges, certainly not throughout the state, there's some differences in the culture from county to county, but most sitting judges are often not challenged. But if there's an open seat, it can go to an election then. But really, it's for retention. It's an opportunity for the public to say whether they think that this is somebody who has the right temperament and should continue to be a judge.
What are the current demographics for women on the bench nationally?
Well, I did not do my research for all of the nation prior to coming, but
just start at the top. Let's look at the Supreme Court,
Just for starters. So the demographics in the United States Supreme Court are very different than they were even when I first started as a lawyer. The changes have really been seismic recently. So in the United States Supreme Court, the first woman who was ever appointed was Sandra Day O'Connor by President Reagan, I think, in 1981. And there was not another woman appointed for a dozen years, I think, until Ruth Bader Ginsburg was appointed. I remember reading something from Sandra Day O'Connor saying she was very conscious of the fact that she was the first and that she wanted to do the kind of work that made it easier for there to be a second. And you look now and see that there are three women sitting on the United States Supreme Court, and two of them have been appointed in the most recent administration. And in California, we have a majority of women in the California Supreme Court bench. And that is a first, and that has happened very recently.
Do you think you have a different persona when you're on the bench than you do when you're off? Do you have to sort of prepare yourself to be, you know, the judge, or does it come naturally to you?
I'm a little bit of what you see is what you get. So I don't have a whole different personality that I bring to that position.
Well, the reason I ask is that when you watch TV, which, by the way, is not where I get all of my information. I do listen to the radio. But when you watch TV, you see these judges who are all women at this point, actually. They seem larger than life. They've clearly have a television persona. I mean, are they even real?
So my experience watching any judges on television dates way back to Judge Wapner, I think it was, and the People's Court many years ago. I have not seen Judge Judy other than walking through an airport and seeing it up on the monitor. And I can't speak for other female judges whose courts I'm not in. But what I would say is that, first of all, those are generally small claims court cases, which are contentious. But it's really reality TV. And I do think that it affects how people perceive potentially in my court how things might be when they come in. And I fear sometimes that the courtroom is going to be, you know, outtakes from the Jerry Springer show, because it is, I mean, first of all, I'm in family court. I have a lot of people who are not represented by counsel, and they see on television that people are yelling at each other and that the judge is going to, in turn, either yell at them or to explain to them the error of their ways. And I have to remind them that it's really not like that, and that this is a place where there's a high degree of civility, and it's not reality television.
What is your reaction in situations like that?
It usually only lasts for a moment. That is one place where having a robe on and a well-placed raised eyebrow can be helpful. And I think that because I don't, and the other people in the courtroom do not help to facilitate that, that we immediately bring the level of drama down, and that it's clear that everyone will be heard, but that it's a respectful place, and in many respects, a fairly quiet place where people should feel safe, and there will be a logical and thoughtful procedure. It's usually enough. Occasionally, it's not, which is why there's sometimes a sheriff in the courtroom.
What were you doing before you became a judge?
I was being a lawyer. I had a number of different phases in my career as a lawyer. So before I was a lawyer, I was a school teacher. And then I went to law school. I clerked for a judge for a year. Then I went to the Justice Department in Washington, D.C. While I was there, I did civil work primarily in the areas of environmental law and some general civil practice. Then I went to the U.S. Attorney's Office, and I was a federal criminal prosecutor for a little while. And then I did some work doing federal criminal environmental work around the country. And then my father became ill with Alzheimer's, and my husband and I moved out to California. And while I was there, I continued to work with the Justice Department for a while. Then I was in-house counsel, and then I had my own law firm. And in the middle of all of that, I tried to do some teaching. I taught at Berkeley's law school called Bolt, and taught at Stanford for a year and did some mediations, you know, a little of this and that.
Did you ever sleep?
That I tend to sacrifice that.
And there's kids in this mix too.
There are three kids in this mix, an 11-year-old, a 12-year-old, and a 15-year-old.
Where did they come in terms of the CV you just shared with us?
So where they come in is after my father was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. My husband and I had never wanted children, somewhat unconventionally, I think, our perspective about parenthood. And when my father was diagnosed, it was around the same time that my mother-in-law was diagnosed with cancer. And so we had a parent who was terminally ill on each side of the family, and I think it makes you think about the circle of life. And we thought at that point, did we want to have children, even though we had worked really hard not to have kids for a lot of years? And we decided it did not make us want to have biological children, but it did make us rethink something that we had thought about a long time before, which was to adopt a child that might not otherwise have a home. So we started that process then, and we adopted our first daughter in 2003. And we were surprised about how much we enjoyed being parents. So we adopted another child in 2005. And then 3 years ago, we adopted another daughter who was at that time 12 and a half. We adopted her from China, and she did not speak English. She had lived in an orphanage her whole life. She was in a special needs orphanage, and in the part of China that she was at, which was rural, they did not differentiate between physical and mental disabilities. And she had been born with a cleft lip and a cleft palate that was fairly severe and was not repaired until she was about five, somewhat inelegantly. So in China, as you probably know, most of the children that are available are girls. And even as infants, many of these girls did not get adopted. But when you have the added component of having a disability of any sort, they're essentially viewed as being unadoptable, which is the category that my daughter fell into. And she was just somewhat randomly put on a list shortly before she would have aged out altogether for adoptions in China, and was identified briefly. And we just happened to see her picture during that window of time.
How did you find her in that window, that small window of time?
So we had been contemplating doing an adoption of an older child, and we were thinking about a child maybe between the ages of 6 and 10, probably a boy, and we were specifically not looking in Asia because our younger two daughters are from China, and we did not want them to think that that was the only place that there was need. So we were looking in India and a couple of different countries in Africa, and we had briefly identified a little boy that was available out of Ethiopia, and shortly after we identified him, his orphanage closed, and so he was no longer available for adoption. And there was a website that we were looking on at that time that has thousands of children from all over the world that are available for adoption. And so when we learned that he was not adoptable, for a while we thought maybe that's the universe's way of saying two is good. Two people with two full-time jobs and two children, maybe we're good. But later, late one night, I tend to work somewhat long hours, and I decided when I got online, maybe I would just go back to this website and see what was happening. And that particular website, the most recent child that has been listed for adoption is the picture you see when you log on. And so that picture may only be up for a couple of minutes because there are so many children that they include. And it just so happened that when I logged on, that was the picture I saw. And I didn't want to click on the picture because I could see that it was an Asian girl. But she also looked so old, and I couldn't figure out why her photo was there. And I was thinking, this girl's never going to be adopted. Why is a girl that's this old on the site? I'm just gonna click on so that I can ease my conscience. And once I did, that was sort of it.
Wow. You like to take on a lot, is what I'm gathering here. Let's go back to the 90s. You're working for the Department of Justice under Janet Reno.
Correct.
What were some of the cases that you were working on? Was there one case that stands out in particular?
So during that window of time, I was primarily doing environmental work, and I did both civil and criminal. And one of the criminal cases that I worked on was an investigation of a number of airlines, including the parent company of American Airlines, because there had been a crash on a ValueJet airline, and we learned that that crash occurred because cargo that was in the plane, there were some oxygen canisters that ultimately ended up exploding and causing the plane to go down, which made people begin to inquire what other kinds of things are on aircraft that are perhaps hazardous, and people who are traveling on that aircraft have no idea that it's there. So there was an investigation of many airlines during that time, but one of the cases that I worked on was the one for American Airlines and its parent. And at the time, there was something that was somewhat popular that people could do. It's almost inconceivable now post 9/11, but you could get a free flight somewhere if you were willing to take something on a plane with you that somebody else gave to you. You could carry something with you. You could put it in your luggage. You could carry it with you. You didn't necessarily know what it was. It could be documents of some sort, or it could be a bag that was associated with your name that went on a plane. And that's a little bit disconcerting now.
Like someone would post a classified ad and say, I need to get something from here to there, and I'll buy your plane ticket if you carry it with you?
Yes, it was a mechanism where people could travel very inexpensively to get from one destination to another. Like I said, completely for free, their plane flight, if they were willing to take on some kind of cargo. I don't know if you remember, but back in that day, you were never asked to associate what was in your bag, that it had to be with you, that it had to be yours, that you knew what was in it, so long as you brought it on. And it could contain chemicals. It could contain fertilizer or other things that were flammable. And so what we learned in that investigation is that that practice was ultimately leading to many kinds of things that were hazardous that were being brought onto aircraft, as well as things that were being transported just as cargo, because airlines make money transporting cargo. And that oftentimes those things had caused near-miss problems because there were chemicals that interacted in baggage, for example. And so that case really dealt with trying to transform how the airline industry worked with cargo and with baggage as it was associated with individuals.
How did you get involved in law in the first place?
It was a bit fortuitous. I come from a family of educators. My mom was a teacher. My father started out as a teacher. He went back to school much, much later in life and became a psychologist. But I thought that at one point maybe I would go to graduate school to teach English. And my husband and I were trying to decide who would go to graduate school first. We were already married then. And he wasn't sure what he wanted to do, so I decided I would go first. And as I was thinking about where I was going to apply, I saw a advertisement for the LSAT. And it's a bit embarrassing to admit this now, but I thought it was a bit like a Rorschach test. It was an aptitude test of sorts. I thought that if you took the LSAT, it would help to tell you whether this might be a good path for you to take. Again, it seems inconceivable now since there's a whole cottage industry associated with it.
And you passed?
Well, it's a test that that works well with my skill set, because unlike the GRE or other exams that test how much you know in math, it's really a logic and thinking test. So it went fine.
Okay. That I've never heard of someone taking the LSAT with no preparation before.
And passing. People wouldn't do that now, I don't think.
But they could.
I wouldn't recommend that. But it was quite a few years ago, and as a result, I ended up applying to law school.
And here you are.
And here I am.
Are you still on the board of Girls Inc.?
I am still on the board of Girls Inc.
And what does that entail? What does a board member do?
So Girls Inc. is a national organization, and it has local affiliates. And the affiliate that is in Oakland, which is for Alameda County, does what all of the affiliates do, which is that it helps to serve primarily underprivileged and underserved communities in the form of girls who are often coming from families where no one in their family has graduated from high school, let alone college. And the mission is to get those girls not only through high school, but through college. And the board members that sit on this nonprofit do what they can to help them effectuate their mission. So that includes things like trying to prepare for events and speakers that come where people come and they pay for these kinds of events, but also trying to deal with policy in the organization and the direction that the organization is going to go in the years ahead, and other things that boards deal with as well. Yeah.
What's the best advice about leadership you've ever gotten?
I don't know if this is about leadership specifically, but I would be remiss not to say it. My father's parenting strategy was very much about take personal responsibility for your own actions, which as a child, I wasn't all that fond of. If there was ever any issue between me and anyone else, the first thing my father would ask me is, what did you do? What was your part in this? What do you have to do to fix this? And I think that that message has resonated with me in all parts of my career as a parent and as I think about leadership, and certainly in the role that I have now, that I have quite the good fortune to have.
Thank you. Thank you, Noelle Wise. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
That was Noelle Wise, a judge of the Superior Court of Alameda County. that's our inflection point for today. Is there a woman changing the status quo you'd like to hear from? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, listen to previous shows and sign up for our email updates. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/inflectionpointradio. Follow us and follow me on Twitter at L.A. Schiller. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco, distributed by PRX, and you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller. Thanks for listening.